This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
When it comes to learning all there is to know about Earth's oceans, we've only scratched the surface, or waded in knee-deep, if you want an ocean metaphor. But when it comes to educating people about the waves of new information being learned about the sea, there is no present-day Jacques Cousteau to spread the word.
If you ask an average 7-year-old who Jacques Cousteau is today, they don't know who he is.
That's right.
So we need a new Jacques Cousteau.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk about the challenge of bringing the ocean into the classroom. Then we'll talk about patents, not so much how to get one, but just figuring out what you can and cannot get one for. And we'll spend an academic minute measuring musical ability. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. There is a huge amount of study going on and information being discovered about the planet's oceans. But turning those waves of info into classroom-ready lessons, well, that's the real challenge. Ari Daniel tackles that topic now. Daniel is the producer and host of the Ocean Gazing podcast. In this segment, he talks to Janice McDonald of Rutgers University and Jim Yoder of the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution about the connections between ocean science and educational outreach. They describe the urgent need to translate that science into formal and informal educational opportunities across the country, engaging scientists, educators, and kids everywhere.
Jim Yoder is the Vice President of Academic Programs at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. He's an ocean scientist, and he believes in educating the public.
We're all funded by taxpayer money, and so it's very helpful to have a population of citizens that that understands the value of scientific research, understands what we're trying to do, and we hope would be supportive of the efforts and understand the benefits to them. I think that's the sort of the big picture story. Also, to engage kids at a young age is important in terms of in our recruitment efforts. And I know I got into ocean science because I read a book in sixth grade that made it sound very interesting and exciting, and I pursued it because of that.
And what was that book you read in the sixth grade?
It was the classic one that everyone read in the sixth grade about the Silent World by Jacques Cousteau, which I bought from my father as a birthday present. He never read it, but I did.
Janice McDonald is the Science, Engineering, and Technology 4-H agent at Rutgers University. Coincidentally, her interest in ocean science is also related to both Jacques Cousteau and her dad.
My father never graduated high school, but he always encouraged me to be a scientist and always thought that would be a great career for me. We watched Jacques Cousteau religiously on TV together every Sunday, so that was our dream together, to be in this exciting world that Jacques Cousteau seemed to lead every week on his TV show.
I mean, what's interesting is that Jacques Cousteau, I feel, marries exactly these two areas. I mean, he was a scientist and an educator.
Yeah, and it shows the power. If you have people that can speak articulately and demonstrate to the general public and to school children the exciting things that happen in the ocean, what it can do. You know, he had a tremendous impact. Not just on in terms of recruiting people into the field, but of getting people interested in the ocean and feeling that it was an important area of the planet to study.
The important thing to know about Jacques Cousteau, though, is if you ask an average 7-year-old who Jacques Cousteau is today, they don't know who he is.
That's right.
So
that's
we need a new Jacques Cousteau, and I think we really do want to fill the pipelines with people who want to be scientists. We got to inspire the kids that we work with to be ocean scientists.
Or if not ocean scientists, to at least appreciate the ocean and understand why it's important to know more about it.
One way that McDonald and Yoder are doing this is through COSEE, or the Centers for Ocean Sciences Education Excellence. If you've listened to the credits of this podcast before, you've probably heard me mention COSEE. Product of the Centers for Ocean Sciences Education Excellence. Special. And maybe you've asked yourself,
what exactly is COSEE?
It's really all about trying to get ocean scientists in particular to work with educators, whether they be in informal learning institutions like a science center or a zoo or aquarium, or even an educator who's in the classroom on the ground in the K-12 formal environment, getting them to work with scientists in ways in which they can take the science that the scientist is doing and translate it in a way that's usable for public audiences for the overall goal of improving their ocean literacy, which means understanding your impact on the ocean and its impact on you.
And why is this an important mission?
Well, we're in a time where we have a very changing planet, and I think it's more important than ever that people understand and become part of the environment. The fact that the ocean influences our weather and our climate and food production, just about everything you can think of, I think it's really key and important for schools to think about that and integrate that into their content standards. I think it's important for scientists in terms of feeding the pipeline of students who can become future scientists. I think it's important for the general public as they make decisions in their local county government, state, national, at all three levels. It's really important to know something about the ocean that covers our planet.
And COSI's pursuing its mission in a variety of ways, through this Ocean Gazing podcast, for example.
For Ocean Gazing so far, we've really tapped into, you know, some of the most interesting and cutting-edge scientists that are involved in ocean observing systems. So you've heard from a variety of folks who've been sort of at ground zero of the development of ocean observing systems, and having them from their perspective, from their own voice, tell you why they're doing what they do and why ocean observing systems are so interesting and important to them as a new tool in ocean sciences.
So far, I'm very pleased that we've hit all these hit different fields, we've hit different parts of the country, and I think we'll try to, you know, continue with that approach.
And remember those underwater robot gliders that Oscar Schofield and Scott Glenn were talking about a couple podcasts ago? Well, there's one on its way right now from New Jersey to Spain. It's being piloted by Rutgers undergrads. Besides all the ocean sensors it has packed into it, it's got some important cargo.
We've asked kids to write letters to be put inside that glider as it makes its voyage across. And we had over 200 letters submitted from kids around the country, and they've had a lot to say about what it means to them. They love the discovery part of it, or the idea that they can be along for the ride, reading the blogs and being part of that mission vicariously through the web and through the online tools that we've developed for them.
Here are a few of those students reading their letters.
Hello, my name is Janani.
Hello, my name is Megha, and I'm 9 years old.
Hello, my name is Jacqueline Kell, and I am a student here at Durand Elementary.
My name is Samuel Seeger, and I am an 8th grade student at Hampton Academy Junior High School in Hampton, New Hampshire.
Hello, my name is Justine Lopez.
My name is Joey Herter from Oregon. I am an Oregon Ducks fan and a New York Giants fan.
Alex from South Brunswick. I'm from 4th grade and have exclusive knowledge of the manta ray. If you have any questions about coral reefs or manta rays, I can help you.
I don't think your glider will make it because it didn't make it the first time. I know that the ocean is unforgivable.
If you are reading this letter, you are touching a piece of history.
I have got some questions for you.
What is the glider made out of?
Will there be more gliders like this one to travel across the ocean?
Does the glider have an engine?
Is the glider prepared for any interactions with sea life?
Why is the glider so small? What is the glider made of?
Will you send a different glider if this one doesn't make it to Europe?
Are there going to be other gliders going around the other oceans too?
Why is the glider named the glider?
How will it be protected from the sharks?
I hope your mission is as successful as Christopher Columbus. Fondly, Nikita.
P.S. Good luck.
And it's not just the kids that are getting excited.
Teachers love it because they don't have a lot of access to scientists, and being able to chat with them online and being able to see that data come across their screen in real time connects them. So it's a way of connecting people intellectually with what's going on in the ocean and not having to worry about physically being out on the boat. I mean, then, so of course, nothing replaces that. Everybody wants to feel the salt spray on their skin and be out there in the real ocean, but this is a way to connect people virtually in a way that has some meaning and some context that they can feel part of the scientific mission.
Thanks for listening. Go to our website, www.cosinow.net, to hear Janice McDonnell and Jim Yoder talk about ocean literacy and ocean observing systems. On to the thank yous.
I thank Janice McDonnell.
And I thank Jim Yoder.
I'll thank Saj Lichtenwalner and Sam Brown. Ocean Gazing is funded by the National Science Foundation, and it's a product of the Centers for Ocean Sciences Education Excellence. Now you should know what that is.
And that's Ari Daniel, the producer and host of the Ocean Gazing podcast. You can find the podcast on iTunes or at cosenow.net. That's CoseeNow.net. Still to come, getting a patent takes a bit of work. Figuring out what is patentable, well, that's a much bigger hill to climb. That story's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1243. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Okay, I'll try to go slow because this is, well, a little complicated. Whoever invents or discovers any new and useful process, machine, manufacture, or composition of matter, or any new and useful improvement thereof, may obtain a patent, therefore subject to the conditions and requirements of this title. That's some of the first patent law ever written in the U.S., and ever since, the courts have construed this statement as covering, in the words of the U.S. Supreme Court, anything under the sun made by man. Although this language is very encompassing, not everything is patentable. Inventions must be both novel and non-obvious. In addition, laws of nature, natural phenomena, and abstract ideas are not patentable. But novel applications of laws of nature, natural phenomena, and abstract ideas can be patentable. The courts have been struggling with just how much application is required to turn an unpatentable natural phenomena or law of nature into a patentable invention. And a recent U.S. Supreme Court decision involving a company called Prometheus, a company which had a patent on a method of administering drugs, has factored into future patents of this sort. The court threw out that patent. In a recent issue of the journal Clinical Chemistry, Jill Paulick, legal counsel and a patent attorney at Ohio Technology, wrote an opinion piece on the fine lines drawn in the decision reached in the Prometheus case and over similar patent decisions. We spoke recently, and I asked Ms. Paulick about the basics of patents and how long they last.
Okay, a patent is a form of intellectual property that protects inventions, but it's an unusual form of intellectual property because it gives you the right to exclude others. Most people think a patent gives you the right to practice your invention, but other people can have patents on different aspects of your invention, so it just gives you the right to exclude others. So anybody who wants to practice your invention needs a license from you to get it. You asked how long a patent lasts. There was a change of patent term in 1995. Any patent application that was filed with the U.S. Patent Office prior to 1995 is good from 17 years from the date it issues. And there have been a few of those that have issued in the past few years. So there still are some out there with that earlier term, which would get them 17 years from the date they issue. In 1995, they changed the patent rules, and they're now more consistent with what the rest of the world does. And what the rest of the world does is you get 20 years from your earliest filing date. So if you filed a patent application in 2000, it would expire in 2020. There are a few exceptions to that, which would take a long time to go into, that can make your patent term a little bit longer, just by a year or two, maybe three. I've seen a few that have been longer than that, but not significantly. Once a patent expires, it is expired. You cannot buy more patent life.
You can't renew that.
You cannot renew a patent. Once it's gone, it's gone.
I had heard, like, with songs or compositions, you have a copyright, and then you
copyright.
Can... Yeah, that's a different thing?
That is a different thing. Copyrights are much longer term. Trademarks protect a term that is used in commerce, and trademarks can be good as long as you are using it.
Well, let's talk about just what can you patent. Can you patent anything? What types of things are under the patent umbrella?
The definition of patentability is very broad, and basically the courts have interpreted the patent statute to include anything under the sun made by man. But there are some caveats to that. It must be new, it must be useful, and it must be non-obvious. You can patent improvements on pre-existing objects, but the improvement must be non-obvious from what went before. And they must be inventions. I often get situations where people have gone traveling abroad, particularly to someplace remote, and they come back and say, hey, I saw this really cool gadget. Can I patent it? I've never seen anything like it in the United States. And no, they can't patent it. They didn't invent it. That's copying. You must be the inventor or a group of inventors to patent something. But there are a number of things that you cannot patent, however. You cannot patent obvious improvements. You cannot
patent things that exist in nature. If you're out rock hounding and you find a new rock or mineral that nobody has discovered before, that's a discovery and not an invention. You cannot patent that mineral. You didn't make it. Now, if you were to synthesize something in a laboratory that was identical to something that might exist out in nature, you can patent your synthesized version. You might be able to patent the process of making it or a way of extracting that mineral from its natural environment, but you can't patent that natural item. And this is one of the things that courts are struggling with right now in several recent lawsuits, is where is that line between what is nature, what is natural, and what is patentable?
And I guess the next question would be, what do you have to describe or do to get to patentable subject matter?
A patent consists of several parts. There's usually a set of figures, although some biotech patents don't need any figures and you might not have any. There's usually figures, there's a description, and there's this set of numbered paragraphs at the end called the claims. I've seen patents with as few as one claim and as many as several hundred. And the claims describe the boundaries of the invention, and what you need for patentable subject matter is enough information to let somebody of ordinary skill in the art of that invention to make or use the invention. You don't have to describe every single step in the process if those steps are ordinary and somebody in that field would recognize it, but you have to have enough detail in the patent itself to allow somebody of ordinary skill of the art to practice the claims at the end.
Well, now that the Prometheus patent has been found to be invalid by the Supreme Court, can anyone practice the methods described for measuring thiopurine metabolites and adjusting thiopurine dosages?
That's an interesting question, and the answer is not a yes or no answer. Prometheus has lost their patent. The Supreme Court has decided they have very few options left. If a doctor were to perform the steps involved in their methods, Prometheus could not go after them for patent infringement because the patent has been declared to be invalid. However, as I said before, patents are a negative right, and other people may have patents on various other steps in the Prometheus process, or may have patents on steps that a specific doctor might use in performing the basic invention. And I haven't done the research on that. I don't know what patents are out there. So I can't say with any certainty that, yes, you can practice this invention. What I can say is, yes, you can practice this invention with respect to these Prometheus patents.
Well, here's the big one now. Can you patent a DNA sequence?
Currently, yes, you can. And this relates to another lawsuit that is working its way through the courts, and that's the Myriad Genetics case. Myriad has a number of patents on genes relating to the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes. These are the breast cancer and ovarian cancer genes. And the patents have been challenged in court. And initially, some of the claims were found to be invalid by the federal district court. That's the trial court. Myriad challenged that ruling to the federal circuit. And the federal circuit found that DNA sequences, isolated or purified DNA sequences, are patentable subject matter. So currently, yes, DNA sequences are patentable. However, the Prometheus case was decided in March of 2012, and a few days after the Supreme Court handed down their decision in the Prometheus case, they asked the Federal Circuit, the Court of Appeals for patents, to reconsider their decision in light of the Supreme Court's decision in Prometheus. So that case has now gone back to the Court of Appeals and will, however it's decided, likely be appealed to the Supreme Court. We'll see if the Supreme Court takes it and what they do with it. So, like I said, currently the answer is yes, but that may change.
So if the Supreme Court ultimately finds that Myriad's patents are invalid, then are all DNA patents invalid?
No, I don't think so. Certainly the ruling would apply to Myriad patents and any patents that are similar to Myriad's. The Myriad claims at issue, there were several different types, but I'm going to talk specifically about the isolated DNA claims. There are many patents that exist that are similar to that, but there are many other patents that are formulated in different ways. For example, many patents claim kits for testing specific DNA sequences, and those kits may contain some isolated DNA. They usually contain an enzyme such as TAC polymerase, which is a bacterial enzyme, and then some other components for amplifying the DNA to test it. That kit itself, with that combination of perhaps human or other species DNA with the bacterial enzyme, does not exist in nature. And while I do not sit on the Supreme Court and don't know how the Supreme Court would ultimately decide, a negative finding for Myriad, a finding that their patents are invalid, would not necessarily affect this type of kit claim or any other type of patent that has subject matter where you have different products from perhaps different species or some synthetic and some naturally occurring products. Those patents, in my opinion, would be valid even if a Myriad had a negative finding.
They wouldn't be automatically invalid, but might this be used as precedent?
It could be, and certainly there will be people who will try to challenge various types of kit claims, but it would take years to get through the courts. The Myriad case has been going on for a few years. I don't have the dates in front of me, but it started a few years ago. Many of these cases can take 6, 8, 10 years before they're completely resolved. So in the near term, kit claims and various types of method claims that are outside of any potential negative finding from Myriad would still be valid for years to come.
Jill Pawlik is a legal counsel and patent attorney at Idaho Technology. Do you think it might be possible to objectively measure a person's musical ability? It certainly won't be easy. And that's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. Is there a way to measure an individual's musicality? Daniel Muhlenziefen, senior lecturer in psychology at Goldsmiths, University of London, developed a system that aims at measuring just how musical a person is.
Lenny Bernstein had it, Goldie has it, Nigel Kennedy has it as well, not to forget others such as Beatles producer George Martin and radio DJ John Peel. But what is it? All of those people can be described as musical, each in their own individual way. Everyone would agree with that. But surprisingly, or maybe not, it is far more difficult to find consensus on what it actually means to be musical, and, even more difficult, how to measure it. To get a handle on this question, we recently developed the Goldsmiths Musical Sophistication Index, or Gold MSI, a new self-report questionnaire that comes together with a battery of objective listening tests. The Gold MSI assesses all aspects of how people can actively engage with music in a skilled way, regardless of musical style. The Gold MSI was rolled out to a large audience together with the BBC, with more than 150,000 people taking the test, including more than 90,000 participants from Britain. This allows us for the first time to investigate the musical profile of an entire nation and the comparison with other population statistics, such as the wealth of the local area that participants lived in. The results have now been published, and one main finding shows how wealth is significantly correlated with the amount of musical training that people have received in their lives, but also with their performance on the objective listening tests. For every point scored on the beat perception test, the average weekly income of the community living at the participant's postcode was £99 higher. And for every point on the melody memory test, the average increase was £111. So far, these are just correlations, but the next step is to look into causal mechanisms. Can people from a wealthier background simply afford more music lessons? Or does music make you smarter and ultimately richer? Or is there a common third factor, such as intelligence or personal ambition, that affects where you live and how good you are with music?
That was Daniel Muhlenziefen of Goldsmiths, University of London. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.